Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A new attempt to reduce the flow of oil into the Gulf of Mexico is met with partial success, but it still could be August before the BP oil leak is stopped. Oil is washed ashore in four states. Cleanup costs continue to mount. BP announced it's initiated a second round of payments to individuals and small businesses who file loss of income claims. And the U.S. government submitted its first bill to BP for its efforts in response to the disaster. Joining me in the studio to talk about paying for the oil spill, Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen, Neil King at the Wall Street Journal, Kevin Book of Clearview Energy Partners. And throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us your messages on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Neil King, if I could start with you, what's the latest on the efforts to cap the leak?
Well, the latest, we're now in day 49, and I think it maybe is fair to say that sort of the worst may be behind us if they're lucky. I mean, they have, this cap has come down. They've been fiddling with it over the weekend. On Saturday, they had kind of a weird thing where they were actually getting so much oil to the surface that, oddly enough, it's kind of startling, they didn't actually have the capacity to deal with it all. They were getting about 10,000 barrels a day, evidently. We don't quite know precisely what percentage of that is, but it may be about half of all the oil that's coming out, maybe even a little bit more than that. Tony Hayward, the CEO of BP, was saying that they anticipate getting the vast majority as they continue to fiddle with this thing. They're dealing, you know, with so much pressure and so much hydrocarbons coming up from underneath that they wanted to make sure that they don't sort of close off these seals on this thing or these valves too quickly in a way that might cause problems. But I think their anticipation in the next couple of days is that they would be getting maybe 14,000 barrels a day, and they have other things that are in the works to actually use some of these pipes or tubes that were put in for this top kill procedure that we all followed so closely that might create another way of getting oil up to the surface. And then in time, they're wanting to replace the existing cap mechanism with something that would be more resilient when hurricanes come into the Gulf, assuming they do this summer, which will be definitely a bad news, a good news sort of thing, maybe a good news, but mainly bad news because they, of course, might have to leave the pipe altogether and just let the stuff flow out if there is a hurricane that comes through, because they wouldn't be able to, you know, keep collecting the oil. And
do we have a sense yet as to the full extent of the spill so far?
I haven't tallied up what the actual numbers are. It's an enormous spill, obviously. I mean, it's certainly the biggest that we've dealt with in our waters. And it's, somebody was saying over the weekend, it's the size of Vermont. It seems to me that it would probably be even larger than that.
Traveled to four states thus far.
Yeah, it's such an elusive thing on the one hand, because it's you know, washed ashore in certain marsh areas. Certain Louisiana's been hit the hardest. In other states, it's been much more sporadic. And then there's the talk of there being these potential underwater plumes and it moving around to the Keys and all this sort of thing. So, you know, we're going to move on to talk about damages and the like. That's one of the things that's so tough for BP, is just nobody really knows what they're dealing with. And we don't know how long it's going to go on or where the oil is.
Neil King of the Wall Street Journal. Turning to you now, Tyson Slocum, what are the cleanup costs likely to be?
In the billions of dollars, BP has just announced that they've already spent $1.25 billion, and that's mainly dealing with trying to contain the flow of oil that's coming out of the hole they punched in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. But you've got two main types of costs going forward. One is dealing with trying to get the oil out of the marine ecosystem, which is doing everything from containment booms along the shores and other efforts to try to scoop up the oil. But then you've got the secondary costs, and that is the liabilities associated with this, the lost income to fishermen, to folks who live on the coast who depend on tourism for their livelihoods, and various other associated economic costs that BP most likely is going to be held liable for. So BP is looking at potential liabilities of dealing with getting rid of the oil and cleaning up the mess and compensating people for the economic damage, I think, in the tens of billions of dollars.
The Obama administration gave BP a bill for $69 million. I was surprised that that was so low.
Well, that, I think, is just the bill so far that various federal agencies have incurred, like the Coast Guard. You've got additionally a lot of states that have been making expenditures, and that's going to be a separate bill that they're going to be submitting to BP.
Tyson Slocum, he's director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Kevin Book, is there a cap on how much BP could be asked to pay?
Well, there's an explicit cap if their economic damages rise above $75 million. Technically, the Oil Pollution Act caps it there. But if they are found to be criminally liable, then a good estimate is probably about $3,000 per barrel per day. So using Tyson's estimate or Neil's estimate of $20,000 at the upper bound, that at over 50 days' time would rise to about $60 million a day or $3 billion just in criminal liability if they're found to have been criminally negligent. Likewise, there's another way to think about it, which is that there's a total economic cost of tourism and fishing in the four affected states. It's unlikely to be the full cost that they'll bear, but obviously, if you see claims coming in, they could be very large. We estimate that number north of $14 billion.
Now, isn't it true that the leaseholders other than BP also share some responsibility there for the cost? And couldn't that lead to some extensive finger-pointing?
I think the finger-pointing has only begun, Diane. At this point, there's been an almost glasnost-like policy of openness that I think is likely to shift with Eric Holder's declaration last week of the intent to conduct a criminal probe.
But if you've got Anadarko Petroleum, which owns 25% of the leases, and Mitsui with 10%, of the leases, do you see all of them being willing, as Tony Haywood, the chair of BP, said, we're going to make good on these costs? Do you believe that that's going to happen?
Well, it's hard to say whether those companies will make the same claim. What's also unclear is exactly how that liability will be transferred between BP itself and the companies that worked for BP. In the finger-pointing, it hasn't just been across leaseholders, but also across links of the value chain. Questions of whether or not the cement job was of adequate integrity, questions of whether or not the drilling operator, Transocean, had conducted itself properly. Until those questions are resolved, it's unclear exactly how the second tier of lease owners might behave.
Tyson, you have concerns about BP's willingness to really come forth and help out those who have been damaged.
Right. I mean, BP has a terrible track record. We have to remember that the company was on criminal probation at the time of the April 20th explosion. Two of its subsidiaries pled guilty near the end of the Bush administration to criminal violations of two U.S. environmental statutes. And when you look at the Department of Justice documents involved in those numerous investigations, you have a company with a clear track record of evasion, of failing to live up to its obligations and refusing to comply with statutes, particularly when you look at the Alaskan pipeline case that BP pled guilty to. So we have a lot of concerns about BP's track record, and I'm not going to take their CEO's word for it that they're going to make good on making payments. I need to see somebody sign on the dotted line for that.
And Neil King, what about the 11 people who were killed when the rig exploded. Who's responsible to their families?
Well, I think there's probably a mixed responsibility. The rig was a Transocean rig. I mean, there's a whole mix of issues about what actually caused the explosion, and that's been one of the main sources of this sort of finger-pointing. It's a given, I think. One of the cases, the BP cases, was this a big explosion in 2005 at a Texas City refinery in Texas. I think the families got something like $1 billion out of that. There were 15 people that died in that. In this case, there were 11. I'm sure that the dollar amounts are going to be somewhat similar as to whether they'll be shared among the various companies. It seems likely that in some way they will.
Kevin, is it possible that this whole disaster could actually bankrupt BP?
I think the market has taken its biggest swing at that, Diane, and they've come up with about $75 billion of the company's market cap, you know, roughly a third of its value, evaporating in the course of the week since the disaster. That's high relative to the numbers that we've talked about thus far this morning. And in all likelihood, all of that payout wouldn't necessarily have to happen at any one time. It'd probably be phased, whether by litigation or simply by the sequencing of processing claims, that they would be a viable going concern in all likelihood anyway, because they generate a tremendous amount of cash in a very globally diversified way.
Kevin Book, he's Managing Director of Research for Clearview Energy Partners. Short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with the Vice President of BP. Stay with us. And welcome back. As we talk about the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico and its various costs, joining us now by phone from New Orleans is BP Vice President for Resources, Darrell Willis. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
Can you tell me how many claims have been filed so far, and in what amounts?
Yes, so far we've had 37,900 claims filed, and to date we've paid around 18,400 claims, and we've paid out about $49 million in claims over the last 30 days.
Tell me who is eligible to file a claim at this point.
Any person along the Gulf Coast who has been damaged by this spill, who has had any losses of earnings associated with the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, is eligible to go into one of our claims offices to access our claims hotline at 1-800-440-0858 or our website at www.bp.com/claims and file a claim. We'll look at them all.
All right. Darrell, I'd like to play for you and for our audience a tiny excerpt of something the president said just the other day.
My understanding is that BP has contracted for $50 million worth of TV advertising. to manage their image during the course of this disaster. In addition, there are reports that BP will be paying $10.5 billion, a billion with a B, in dividend payments this quarter. Now, I don't have a problem with BP fulfilling its legal obligations, but I want BP to be very clear. They've got moral and legal obligations here in the Gulf for the damage that has been done. And what I don't want to hear is when they're spending that kind of money on their shareholders and spending that kind of money on TV advertising, that they're nickel and diming fishermen or small businesses here in the Gulf who are having a hard time.
And Darrell Willis, I'd be interested in your reaction to the president's statement.
Dan, what I would say is that a month ago, we had two claims offices open along the Gulf Coast. Today, we have 25 offices open. A month ago, we'd written 100 checks across the Gulf Coast. As of yesterday, we've written 18,400 checks. And a month ago, we'd written out $600,000 worth of claim checks. And as of yesterday, we've written out $49 million worth of claims checks. I'm from the Gulf Coast, and I'm going to make sure that our company will do the right thing. We know that we'll be judged by this response. We're going to be reasonable. We're going to be practical. We're going to be fair, and we're going to make sure that the folks of the Gulf Coast, from Louisiana to Florida, are taken care of, and that any damages that they've incurred as a result of this bill, they will be paid for as long as they are legitimate claims, as long as they are substantiated and determined to be reasonable and necessary. We are going to take care of the folks of the Gulf Coast and do the right thing.
Okay, I want to go back to the figures you gave me earlier. You said something like near $49 million with an M have been paid to more than 37,000 people. What is that average out to, Mr. Willis?
It's actually, Diane, $49 million has been paid to 18,400 people. We've actually paid about half those claims. The others are being processed, and in many cases, we're waiting on documentation from the claimants. But to answer your question, if you just do a simple average, it's about $3,000 per claim. But that varies from state to state. It also varies depending on the industry that the claim is coming from.
And how do you come to that conclusion of, say, $3,000 per claim if you've got people who have lost months and months of their ability to fish, to provide services for tourists, for hotels, and the like?
Right. So our claims process has three pieces to it. There's an individual claims process. There is a large loss claims process for businesses that have incurred losses in excess of $5,000. And there's a government aspect to our claims process. And we're going to be addressing claims in all those three areas over the course of this spill. We've only been through the first 30 days. In the first 30 days, we've spent, as I said, almost $50 million. We've just recently we're currently in the process of mailing out the second round of checks for folks who were impacted in May. They'll be getting a check for the month of June. As we speak, those checks are being mailed across the Gulf Coast. And we will do this as long as it takes, as long as people are not able to work and do what they do out here on the Gulf of Mexico. We're going to pay these claims, and we'll do it for as long as it takes.
U.S. officials, I gather, have been assigned to look over that claims process to make sure that BP pays them. Tell me how that's going to work.
We actually, by law, are required as a responsible party associated with the incident in the Gulf of Mexico to run a claims process, and we've been doing that since late April. The Coast Guard oversees this process every day. They receive a report on how many claims we've paid, how much money has been paid out, what are the different categories of claims that have been paid by state. And if someone, for example, goes through our claims process and the claim is denied, and I'm pleased to say that so far we have not denied any claims, any individual has a right to have that claim reviewed by the Coast Guard. And as a result of that process, if it's paid, then the Coast Guard will ask us to reimburse them for that claim.
When we look back on the Exxon Valdez oil disaster, it took literally decades to resolve. Do you believe that things will be different with the BP oil spill?
I do think that things will be different. As I said, we're going to be reasonable, practical, and fair, and we're going to do the right thing. We know that we'll be judged by our response to this spill. And for me personally, as a product of the Gulf Coast, I'm personally invested in making sure that we get this right for the people who need it made right for them.
I must say, people listening to this, however, and hearing your $3,000 per claimant payout might say the president was right, and you are nickel and diming people.
I would say that that $3,000 number is just simply a mathematical average. What's really important is that every person who's been damaged, every person who's been hurt by this bill will be made whole. For every penny that a person loses that they have substantiated and we've determined is a legitimate claim, they will be paid. Some people might get $2,000. Some people might get $10,000. It's going to depend on each individual claim. We'll look at every one. We'll make sure it's reviewed fairly, and we will reimburse them fully for their losses.
All right. Neil King of the Wall Street Journal has a question.
Oh, I do. Okay. Well, one thing I was interested on the formulas, my understanding was that ship captains, for instance, got $5,000 more or less, and that people that were like deckhands on the ships got something like half that. Is it that people come forward with their records to show what they were making before this bill, and then you pay according to that, or do you pay more according to a certain formula?
One of the things we realized when we started this process a month ago was that we could not afford to wait to get money into the hands of the people who have been hurt by this bill. And at the beginning of this process, it was going to take about 45 days to get money into the hands of folks along the Gulf Coast. That was not acceptable. So what we did was we figured out how could we streamline this process and get money into the hands of the people who needed it the most as soon as possible. So we cut a process down from 45 days to within 48 hours of filing a claim and presenting the documentation, a person can receive a check for their compensation. So the first month of this process, it's been simplified. We assumed a certain amount for captains and deckhands. If a person actually makes more money, they will be trued up. We will give them the incremental money that they were not paid. If a person has made less money and they got more from us than they should have, they'll be allowed to keep that money.
All right, and I know you have to leave us soon, but what will you be paying? What will BP be paying to the families of the 11 who died?
BP and Transocean are currently in discussions around that. I am actually running the claims process on the ground and responding to the needs of the community, and that has been my focus.
So you have no input, no knowledge of what BP might be paying to the families of those who died.
My focus has been on managing the needs of the folks, the fishermen, the crabbers, the shrimpers, the local businessmen along the Gulf Coast who've been hurt. That's been my focus over the last 30 days.
Darrell Willis, BP. He's Vice President for Resources. Thanks for joining us, sir.
My pleasure, Diane.
And if you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, John. You're on the air. John, are you there? Let's go to Shelter Island, New York. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I just wanted to shed some light on some long-term costs that are very difficult to put values on and budget for. These are costs of the loss of, like, ecological services that the coastline performs for not only fishermen, but for, you know, a more large-scale area of the region and even global for migratory birds, let's say, and all the productivity that the marsh offers, you know, second to coral reefs. I was wondering if these types of ideas and impacts have been accounted for in any of the costs for recovery.
Kevin.
Thanks for the question. We actually have had some trouble trying to estimate them ourselves. Part of the problem, as Neil mentioned, is the size and extent of the plume. But second, if you look at the historical ecological lawsuits and what they've recovered, it's not been very much money at all. The most we've assigned in any of estimates that we put together is about $100 million based on historical comparables. But the problem here is that there is no historical comparable here in the U.S.
The thing is, too, we're in such incredibly early days right now. I mean, in a lot of these places, it's the damage is somewhat theoretical because it hasn't actually really in significant amounts come ashore in a lot of places. And we have no real way to gauge the underwater damage that might be occurring, with the what we believe to be the suspended amounts of oil. I mean, there's so many unknowns. It's day 49. I think these things are going to play out over a really long time.
Neil King of the Wall Street Journal, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Frederick, Maryland. Good morning, Phil. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane. With Mr. Willis, my question to him would be, if he's paying claims to these people at an average of, $3,000 or whatever it was, I don't understand how they're actually settling these claims, because this loss is an ongoing loss. We don't know where the end of this thing is until August. And these people who are lost income, how can they accept $3,000 when their income may end up being a loss of much more than that? It sounds like they're trying to run in real quick, show them the money, and hope that they sign a release form. So the question, too, is, are they making these people sign a release form of legal liability, or is this an open-ended claim process where they can readdress the issue later on if they have a larger loss than what they initially thought it was?
Thanks, Phil.
So, yeah, the caller is raising an excellent point, because we're hearing a lot of firsthand accounts from some of the people that BP has hired to help clean up the spill, like some of the fishermen. And we know that if those fishermen have a lawyer, they are not going to get hired by BP. And I think one of the central questions that Congress needs to be asking is whether or not BP is forcing any of the people that are getting these relatively small upfront payments, whether or not that cancels their ability to pursue litigation in the future.
Yeah, I don't actually think that that's an issue myself, but from what I've read, the caller was a little bit mistaken. These are actually monthly payments, like they're already saying that by the end of this month, they're expecting the $49 billion to be more like $90 million. So this is, if you're estimated to have lost $3,000 a month in income, that's essentially what they'll be paying these people for as long as that income's being lost. I mean, the odd thing about this is there are basically two tracks. There's this compensation, monthly compensation stuff, and then there is this humongous iceberg of litigation that's out there that's going to be, we're going to be dealing with for years.
But then I want to understand the one-time compensation, Neil, is, and how much of that $49 million is a one-time.
No, my understanding is not a one-time. It's to make these people something approximating whole while this goes on and they aren't able to work.
He didn't say that.
Yeah.
He didn't say that.
Isn't that your understanding?
My understanding, Diane, was that it sounded like he said the first payment was made on the basis of a formula because of the length of time associated with reviewing the claim, and that these claims probably would be revisited should they have underpaid by formula. Or he also said, I believe, that they could keep the money if they'd overpaid.
Okay. And caller in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Tom.
Hi. Good morning. My question was, what can and should the administration be doing to mitigate the damage? Is federal disaster aid available? I mean, I understand the criticism of BP and holding them accountable. But I'm just wondering if the federal government can provide resources to help mitigate the damage.
Tyson.
Well, I think the federal government already has, which is represented in that $69 million bill that the federal government submitted to BP. But I do think that we need to be keeping a closer eye over the way that this company is handling the claims and payment process. I mean, this is a company, again, with a terrible track record when it comes to complying with U.S. laws and regulations. And it's not prudent for us to simply say we'll trust BP again on this. And I'm going to respectfully disagree with the spokesperson from BP who came on and said, you know, BP cares about the people on the Gulf. If BP cared about the people in the Gulf, they wouldn't have cut corners on that Deepwater Horizon rig and made a series of critical decisions that directly led to this catastrophe. I mean, BP has a clear track record of cutting corners, of willfully violating U.S. laws and regulations. And we really need to start thinking about what kinds of permanent sanctions need to be applied against a company that has a poor track record like
Kevin.
That.
Dan, I think that one of the things that's easily misunderstood here is that we don't have a national oil company. There's no way the federal government can do anything but work with the private industry, and that's actually not a bad thing. It's a good one. It's proven to be tax efficient for us over the years. What's a challenge is making sure that everything's done right.
Kevin Book of Clearview Energy Partners. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls, your email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
Her great-grandfather bought the Washington Post during the Great Depression. Her grandmother brought it to prominence during Watergate. Catherine Weymouth on the challenge she faces as publisher of the paper in the digital age, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And as you can imagine, we have many phone calls, many emails, many messages. Here's one from Chris, who says monetary issues are the least of what the real concerns will be. How in the world does BP or anyone rectify the environmental damage that will have impacts for decades ahead? It's my opinion we are witnessing the pending extinction of the Gulf Coast as we know it. Tyson.
Yeah, I definitely share that concern. You cannot pump this volume of oil and the chemical disbursements, which is a big issue that a lot of folks haven't been talking about. I mean, BP's had a lot of incentive to dump hundreds of thousands of gallons of disbursements because they're not going to be liable for damages that that occur to fish life or to cleanup crews. But you can't put a price tag on the kind of devastation that we're seeing in the Gulf of Mexico. And this really forces us to reevaluate whether or not we can continue ultra-deep water drilling if we don't have any technology to effectively stop catastrophic blowouts like
and
this.
And we have several emails like this one. This oil disaster must be the bottom we hit in our addiction to oil. Recovery solutions are simple. Solar rooftop energy generated by utility customers is taking place in cloudy Germany, Gainesville, Florida, and Ontario. What do your guests think of using this disaster as a catalyst for recovery? Kevin.
It's, I think, going to happen politically in the next several weeks. It's obviously become one of the talking points to Majority Leader Reid's pitch for a climate bill. But the reality here in the United States is one we may be uncomfortable admitting, which is that we're not just addicted to oil. We're addicted to the cheapest energy we can get, and we expect it. Politically, it's very difficult to do what Germany did, unless you own all of the utilities at a federal level, and you have the kind of collectivism that you find in Germany. It's not a base case, it's an exception.
Now, here is, we moved from monetary cost to environmental cost, and now to political costs. Here's an email from Jeremy in Dallas, who said, the Sunday talk shows all address the impact of the oil spill on the Obama legacy. One speaker compared its potential impact to the Iran-Contra affair's impact on Carter's presidency. Could the BP spill have such an impact on the Obama administration? Neil King.
My guess is not. I mean, in part because the Iran hostage crisis overlapped much more, well, went on for a long, long time and then consumed the election season. There's very little likelihood that this will still be a big issue in 2012, which is the year that Obama cares about. We were talking a little bit about this before the show, that it's been odd. There's been such an incredible fixation, really, I think more so on how the Obama administration has dealt with this than how BP has, or just sort of the oil industry in general. I mean, it's almost as if the White House has been more sullied in some fashion or harmed by this than the oil company, BP, or just the oil industry in general.
Now, is that wishful thinking on his opponent's part?
I think it's just a fixation that we have as a nation on what it is that the White House does or doesn't do, and just this extraordinary desire to fix blame primarily on one person or one particular place, even when in this case it's such an unusual disaster where there's so little that the government can actually do.
All right. To Rochester, New York. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning. Tyson Slocum, first of all, I'd wonder, what are the chances of suing to open the books on the Cheney Energy meeting? I believe that the regulatory system was gutted during that meeting, and also the fact that this company is not a union shop where organized labor would offer a counterbalance to the corporate railroading of the employees, who probably would have stopped this from happening.
Well, first, the public citizen lawyers actually argued the case about the Cheney Energy Task Force before the Supreme Court, and we lost. And the deregulation of Minerals Management Service regs didn't happen during that meeting. It was over a series of years where you had institutional problems at the Minerals Management Service, where the agency was a cheerleader for drilling, because it was responsible for trying to collect enormous federal revenues for selling leases and collecting the royalties for the production on those leases. And I think it's clear that worker safety, that environmental protection was not a priority of the Minerals Management Service in regulating offshore drilling, and that absolutely must change going forward.
And the administration is in the process of doing just that. Kevin.
Diane, I think that's exactly right. There's an institutional conflict. You cannot be both the safety and soundness regulator and also be the financial regulator. But the caller is unfortunately putting it in the wrong decade. Excuse me. The Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act was amended in 1978 to put the 30-day turnaround on well-planned reviews by the MMS. The culture of move ahead for energy security actually goes back to the second of the damaging oil crises in the decade that Carter was president. So the comparisons, I think, in many ways are easy to make. They sound sinister, but we've been trying to produce these resources as quickly as possible for a long time as a country, irrespective of who's in charge.
But, Kevin, talk about the Cheney meetings with the oil executives and why none of that information was ever released.
Yeah, I'm I'm sure Tyson is much more up on the history of all that, why that wasn't released. I mean, that was obviously early on in the Bush administration. There was a lot of the whole energy agenda that was up in the air at the time. Obviously, that administration was certainly much more prone to, you know, go deeper, farther, faster than the previous one. And there was a lot of suspicion about what that actually entailed. I would agree with what Kevin was saying, that, I mean, the Mineral Management Service, I don't think was ever really a legitimately robust regulator. It was an enabler, you know, for the good of the nation, as everyone saw it, to find more of our resources, particularly oil and particularly offshore, because that's where more and more of it is. And there's never really been all that muscular and oversight.
All right. To Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
My concerns, along with all of these other ones, the environmental, I mean, it's just heartbreaking. But the other concern that I have is our health concerns. And why I'm bringing this up is I had occasion in the late 90s to be at the Cleveland Clinic on a regular basis. There were a lot of people from Saudi Arabia who were at that clinic being treated for Lou Gehrig's disease. When my family relative passed away, shortly after that, I found that there was a doctor here in Kentucky at the University of Kentucky who was doing research on the high incidence of ALS with military members who had fought the fires, the oil fires in the Gulf. My big question is there a connection between being exposed to oil fires, oil residue?
Sure.
Is there a higher incidence of ALS?
Interesting. Tyson.
Well, there's no question that being exposed to petroleum products is dangerous. The federal government regulates the vapors coming out of the gas pump when you're filling up your car. So the concern that we have is that BP is hiring on a contract basis hundreds of fishermen, giving them maybe a couple of hours of training. These folks are great at being fishermen. They may not necessarily be great at hazardous waste removal and cleanup.
What kind of equipment are they wearing?
They're being issued all sorts of protective clothing, but you know, you're working out there in the open ocean. It's hot as heck, and wearing some of those full safety outfits can be extremely hot. And so our concern is that we don't have properly trained crews that are first responders here, and I do have concerns about long-term health implications
and
for these folks.
You know, somebody ought to do a study, as she mentions, if you've had lots of people from Saudi Arabia being treated for ALS, to find out whether there is some kind of connection. Have you heard anything to that effect, Neil?
I haven't. I mean, there have been, over the last couple of weeks, these reports of some illnesses that some of the workers have faced. And I think OSHA came in and has decided that they were disputing it a little bit and saying that they didn't need to use, you know, face masks, basically. You know, this is another area, just like the dispersants, where we're in sort of terra incognita in terms of how to deal with this or what the risks are, which goes to show, again, how unprepared we were for this and how little sort of study we had done
in
advance.
To Havana, Florida. Good morning, Reed.
Good morning, Diane. You know, early in the show, your panel was talking about the finger-pointing that's been going on, and it's been very frustrating to me because I believe that, first and foremost, if we're going to point a finger, we need to point in the mirror. I live in the Gulf area, and I'm as bad as anybody with my insatiable consumptive nature. I got to drive. I got to, you know, do everything that people do when they think the Earth is their bounty. But the most frustrating thing to me is that everybody keeps pointing to President Obama, including Governor Jindal, who, as a congressman, fought to preserve the rights of the oil companies to do whatever they wanted to do, opposed any regulation, supported deep water drilling, and now he's standing up for the people of Louisiana and calling on the federal government to bail him out.
Neil.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, there's just hypocrisy sort of throughout our society. We are a highly dependent society, obviously, on cheap energy. It is, as George Bush himself said, our core addiction. And there's also, Louisiana is a very conflicted state in that way.
So now the Interior Department has placed a six-month moratorium on deep water drilling. There is a cost there, is there not, Kevin?
There is, Diane. The first cost is actually probably going to be felt, ironically, by the residents of Louisiana, a lot of the folks who work in jobs in offshore drilling, who will be losing those jobs as rigs leave the Gulf of Mexico. Realistically, a six-month moratorium isn't probably all we're going to get. As Tyson has suggested, there's a lot of questions about what will have to be done later. But in the meantime, the safety regulations that the Interior Department has already asked the president to implement and the Congress to implement will involve a rulemaking that takes at least 90 days, and it could go well longer than that. So what you have ultimately is a de facto loss of energy security. It's not huge relative to the world surplus of oil right now, but we could lose 130,000 barrels of production capacity in the Gulf just because of declines. That's about half of what the non-OPEC world will grow by this year.
And we just might have to find it elsewhere. Kevin Book of Clearview Energy Partners, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tyson, do you want to comment?
Well, I think it's clear that the technology to drill in 5,000 feet of water and 13,000 feet of rock has outpaced the ability of our technology to solve a problem when it occurs at the bottom of the ocean. And it is absolutely necessary for us to put a hold on these deep water drilling efforts until we can be sure that this type of crisis can't happen again.
How can we ever be sure, Neil King, when you're going into something like deep water drilling? You don't know everything that could happen. You're taking chances. You're saying we can take care of it. But how do you know you can take care of it?
Well, you certainly never be totally sure. There's, on the other hand, lots of things that could have been different about this particular case. I mean, the history of deepwater drilling in the Gulf has been relatively problem-free. We've never, of course, seen anything remotely like this. But
we've never gone down a mile.
Oh, no, we've gone way deeper than that in the Gulf.
Deeper.
A lot deeper. Twice as deep in a number of places. I mean, this is a relatively unambitious well when it comes to deep water in these days. I think the biggest thing is just that this blowout preventer that was meant to prevent a blowout, as it's called, just was shoddy in a lot of different ways. I mean, it was evidently too old. It had been fiddled around and modified with too long. And we don't know once they finally bring it up and look at it. We'll probably figure out why it didn't work. But there were also, as Tyson was saying, corners that they were cutting. There was a whole lot of things. They were dealing with problems in the last 2 weeks where it was all kinds of irregularities were coming up. And it was just sort of a, let's keep going. We're going to finesse this. We're going to figure it out. They were already over budget. They wanted to seal the thing off and come back later and tap it. And they made a gamble that obviously just backfired in a very big way.
A gamble?
It's a company that has a disturbing track record of making such gambles. We saw it at the Texas City refinery, where they were cited over and over for workplace safety violations, for Clean Air Act violations, when their Alaskan crude oil pipelines spilled 200,000 gallons of crude oil in 2006. When the Department of Justice investigated, they found that for years BP had known about those problems, and they deemed that they were just simply too expensive to take care of. This is a company that when push comes to shove, when a problem arises, they decide to cut a corner to save money in the short term, and we're all paying the price.
I think that it's perhaps a little unfair to look at this and say this is the beginning of the high-risk, never-safe oil production frontier. There's a couple of things that have always been just outside of our knowledge that we've conquered easily in petroleum exploration especially. The Deepwater Drilling Act, Royalty Relief Act of 1995, really opened up a policy that said try new things. And trying new things has to come with a responsibility to know how to solve new problems also. I don't think anyone can dispute that now. But we shouldn't turn away from the unmitigated success of finally growing U.S. production. This is something that is ultimately going to send our dollars overseas if we stop looking.
But, Kevin, doesn't it all come down to integrity and making sure that when you're experimenting with new technologies, you do it in a way that make sure you are operating with integrity.
Absolutely. Not just the integrity of the concern, but also the integrity of the physical structure. And we're seeing already some concerns about other new frontiers on land that are bleeding out of this. If you thought energy security was solved with shale gas, you now have members of Congress asking, well, is that dangerous too? I think it's safe to say that no one in the industry is going to be cutting corners for a while and hopefully never again.
Do you believe that, Tyson?
No, I think that the American people have been suffering for the last couple of years with a lack of integrity by some of America's and the world's largest corporations, whether it's Wall Street, whether it's the petroleum sector, and we can't just trust these large companies to do the right thing.
Tyson Slocum, Neil King, Kevin Book, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.